And you're listening to Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg. Zia Mian is a physicist, activist, and co-director of Princeton University's Program on Science and Global Security. His research and teaching focuses on nuclear weapons and nuclear energy policy. He's co-chair of the International Panel on Fissile Materials, a group of independent experts from 18 countries working to reduce global stockpiles of nuclear weapon usable material. He serves on the board of the Arms Control Association and received the Linus Pauling Legacy Award for his accomplishments as a scientist and a peace activist in contributing to the global effort for nuclear disarmament and for a more peaceful world. His most recent book is Unmaking the Bomb, a Fissile Material Approach to Nuclear Disarmament and Nonproliferation. Mia, thank you so much for joining us.
How are you?
Good. Although filled with trepidation at this period, perhaps more so than others in the last 10 or 15 years, there was a wonderful treaty on the prohibition of nuclear weapons that was adopted by an overwhelming vote at the United Nations. More than 70 years in the making, the treaty offered widely agreed principles and commitments and mechanisms for ending the nuclear weapons age. Given our political landscape now, however, how meaningful is this prohibition?
It's profoundly important that we have this treaty because it does write into international law the agreed judgment of, as you mentioned, the majority of the world's countries that there is no place in the modern world for nuclear weapons or for military policies built on the possession and threat of use and use of such weapons of mass destruction. It's taken 70 years of really difficult, challenging politics by people and leaders around the world, starting from the bombing of Hiroshima, to get this to happen. So I think that we should recognize it for what it is, the beginning of the end of nuclear weapons.
Talk about the geopolitics that now witnesses nuclear disarmament diplomacy, however. At least I would characterize it as so. Perhaps you have a different position. In meltdown, and certainly no puns intended.
The way that people have thought about the need to control nuclear weapons ever since they were first made by the United States in 1945 has been that it should be the countries with nuclear weapons who should lead the process of getting rid of them. And that made sense at the beginning, since the United States had nuclear weapons, and then the Soviet Union got nuclear weapons. Nobody else had nuclear weapons, and people said, look, you have to decide to get rid of these weapons. And it's worth recalling that the very first resolution ever passed by the United Nations, Resolution 1, called for a plan for the abolition of nuclear weapons. And it's taken us 70 years to get that resolution actually turned into something concrete, because for all of those 70 years, the United States and then Russia, followed by Britain and then France and then China and now the other four countries that also have nuclear weapons, Israel, India, Pakistan, and North Korea, have all said, we will do the right thing. You have to trust us. We will get to nuclear disarmament. And the world has said, we're tired of waiting for you to do the right thing. We are going to write the law that says, now you must do the right thing. And so the politics of nuclear disarmament, the shift that we have seen, is that the failure of the nine countries with nuclear weapons, the most egregious failure of which is that by the United States and Russia, which have thousands upon thousands of nuclear weapons each, more than the rest of the world put together, to not take their obligation seriously and to get rid of their nuclear weapons. And people have said, enough, we're not waiting any longer, we're going to write the law that says you must do this. And now we will figure out how to try and bring that law into force and bring pressure on you to do it. But first, you need the law that says you cannot have nuclear weapons and you cannot threaten to use nuclear weapons. And that we are in the process now of putting in place.
Let's continue to focus on homegrown terrorism, if you will. How do you assess the dangers that come from the Trump administration and his coterie in conjunction with the great power tensions and rivalries, especially between the U.S., Russia, China, and so on?
Well, President Trump has a very mixed view of nuclear weapons. On one day, he's very excited about them and about the size of his nuclear button and how he wants the United States to have the biggest and most destructive nuclear arsenal in the world. On other days, he says, oh, yes, it would be great if we could get rid of them all. So this almost schizophrenic attitude about nuclear weapons is actually pretty characteristic of American presidents going back to the very beginning, to President Truman. When President Truman ordered the atomic bombing of Japan, when Hiroshima was destroyed, Truman wrote in his diary, this is the greatest thing in history. But very soon, Truman realized that nuclear weapons have profound consequences and would not contemplate their use again, for example, during the Korean War. Similarly, we think of President Kennedy and the Cuban Missile Crisis and how close we came, and President Kennedy's struggle with his own advisors to prevent the use of nuclear weapons. And yet, under Kennedy and then through the 60s, the United States had a massive nuclear weapons buildup after the Cuban Missile Crisis, where you would have thought they would have realized that we are at the edge of the abyss that leads to the end of humanity. We have to stop this and roll back the nuclear age, not build more. But they built more. And so this schizophrenia about nuclear weapons both being this incredibly awesome weapon that is terrifying, and yet their idea that if we had more, we could somehow dominate, is something that's been characteristic of presidents. And even with President Obama, we had an arms control treaty with Russia to reduce the number of operational nuclear weapons that were deployed and ready to use. And yet at the same time, the Obama administration committed to a massive $1.2 trillion, I'll say that again, $1.2 trillion modernization of all of the U.S. nuclear weapons over the next 30 years, with new missiles, new submarines, new bombers, new nuclear warheads to sit on all of these things. And so presidents have gone along having both been terrified of nuclear weapons and of wanting more. And so, you know, there's nothing extraordinary in how Trump sees nuclear weapons, except perhaps his kind of lack of restraint in talking about them.
One of the things that I've heard you say in other presentations and discourses is that it's an antiquated idea, for example, that we control the technology, thus we control the nuclear future. And you said the world doesn't work that way, and I just want to think about that in terms of imbuing some hope that the rest of the world, certainly those who signed the non-nuclear proliferation treaty, can really have a commanding effect on the ultimate abolition of nukes.
In the effort to try and get rid of nuclear weapons and control the technology and materials that make nuclear weapons possible, from the World War II creation of nuclear weapons until about 1968, there was basically a runaway nuclear arms race. More and more countries were starting to get them, and the technologies and the materials for making nuclear weapons were spreading. And both the United States and the Soviet Union at that time had great fear that more and more countries around the world would get nuclear weapons, and that as they got nuclear weapons, this would be a threat to the power of the United States and the Soviet Union during the Cold War to have their way in crises around the world. And so they came up with the idea of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. This was something that the United States and the Soviet Union negotiated with each other and then told the world, this is how we will control nuclear weapons. And part of that treaty, which was first signed in 1968, so it's 50 years old this year, was a promise that the countries with nuclear weapons at that time would negotiate to get rid of them. And the rest of the world said, okay, we promise not to try and make nuclear weapons, given that you've promised to negotiate to give them up. So we waited 50 years for them to keep that promise, and they didn't. There have been no negotiations among the countries with nuclear weapons to give up their nuclear weapons. And people have basically said, all right, we're tired of waiting for you. We're going to just decide what the end result of that negotiation should have been. But in the meantime, what's happened, and this is very important, is that the withdrawal of consent by the majority of the world's countries from this global nuclear agreement that we had, to say, look, you know, we're tired of waiting. We don't trust you to do the right thing. We're going to figure out what the right thing is and make you do it, is the beginnings of a new way of thinking about what to do about nuclear weapons. Because now there's no question of appealing to the United States and the other countries with nuclear weapons to do the right thing. Now we have countries who are taking upon themselves the obligation themselves to try and figure out how to make the United States and others give up nuclear weapons, including having now law on their side, where the next time there's a threat to use nuclear weapons, once the treaty enters into force, countries will say, actually, you know you're violating international law whenever you threaten to use nuclear weapons. You know that your policies of nuclear deterrence and building more nuclear weapons are a violation of international law, because up to now, the nuclear weapon states have been able to say, we're not doing anything wrong. There's no law that says we can't do this. And we've promised that one day we'll get rid of them. Well, all of that now has to change. So I think that it's not so much a matter of the spread of technology, but the taking of responsibility by countries without nuclear weapons for the future of the world, and not wait for the nuclear-armed countries to eventually negotiate the elimination of their nuclear weapons, which is something they promised 50 years ago and just have not delivered on.
The key to long-term progress, certainly most of us, at least I, have felt must be the United States, which more than any other country has certainly set the global nuclear agenda since it made the first nuclear weapons and remains the only country, of course, ever to have used them in war. And it is the country so responsible for the existing international system. And I have so little hope for the democracy in its current evolution of the United States and playing a constructive role at all in the elimination of nuclear weaponry. So you've effectively given me hope, but that other countries and that perhaps the third world nations and so on who understand to their detriment what nuclear proliferation means can influence the process. Is that a kind of political naivete to suggest that it is anything other than the United States which is really calling the shots again, no puns intended?
I think the days where the United States called the shot are passing. And in different issues, they have passed already, which is one reason that you have seen the appeal for so many Americans of the Trump notion of making America great again. They have this romantic, nostalgic notion sometime back in the 1950s when America was great, they thought, and they could basically tell the world what to do. But the world is a very different place now. And the idea that the United States, you know, stands on the world like this giant is long past. It actually has no connection to reality whatsoever. And the fact that almost 20 years after 9/11, the United States is still struggling in Afghanistan, 15 years it's still struggling in Iraq, it can't resolve its conflict in Syria, it can't actually even deal with North Korea or Iran. These are not the signs of a world-dominating superpower, right, that can have its way and set the global agenda. The United States is actually extraordinarily limited in its ability to have its way. And one of the things that is increasingly important is that the resort of the Trump administration is to a much more aggressive, belligerent, militarized foreign policy to try and recover some sense of power and control over the system. But it's not working. It's just simply not working. And even if it works for a little while because they can fire, you know, dozens of cruise missiles into Syria, it doesn't resolve the fundamental underlying issue, which is that the world is not the way that the United States would like it to be, and it hasn't been that way for quite a long time. But there is actually more hope in the American system than you might imagine. One of the things that people have forgotten is that under President Obama, there was actually a profound shift in part of thinking about nuclear weapons. As I mentioned earlier, when Truman ordered the bombing of Hiroshima and the bombing was done and he wrote in his diary, "This is the greatest thing in history," since 1945, no American president ever went to Hiroshima, to the site of the atomic bombing, to engage with the brute fact of that we destroyed an entire city, the first city ever destroyed by a nuclear weapon in the history of the world, and one of only two ever destroyed that way, and the United States destroyed both of them. No American president ever went until Obama. And he went, and he spoke, and he accepted the responsibility of what the United States did, and he hugged a survivor of the atomic bombing and said, you know, we have to try and make sure this never happens again. This marked a major shift in the moral core of what at least one element of American leadership believes to be true about nuclear weapons, that they are wrong. And so the fact that Obama represented a new generation of American politicians, people who, you know, grew up at the end of the Cold War and not in the early years of the Cold War, who have no romantic notions of a white male Christian America in the 1950s ruling the world. These are signs of progress. The next generation of young Americans, the millennials and people of similar age, overwhelmingly don't support nuclear weapons. All the polling shows that it is older people, not younger people, who think nuclear weapons are a good idea. The future is on our side as young Americans start to get some distance from the idea of America as a superpower with some entitlement to shape the world. So I think that with the rest of the world and the next generation of young Americans, and more women are opposed to nuclear weapons than men are opposed to nuclear weapons. Minorities are more opposed to nuclear weapons than white men are opposed to nuclear weapons. So there is a political coalition to be built in the United States among progressives, among women, minorities, young people, people who care about the environment, and the rest of the world, which can actually take on the American military-industrial complex and the old ideas about America and power and force and how to run the world, that can actually change things. So there is lots of reasons for hope.
How do you assess, I know that you were actually just in Seoul, your concerns and your assessment about the upcoming talks with North Korea?
Leaders of North Korea and South Korea are meeting, and this is an enormously important meeting. Only the third meeting between the leaders of those two countries since the Korean War, you know, is this continuing effort by progressive-minded politicians in South Korea to try and build a peace process with the North. And with luck, and all the signs are positive so far, that it will be a successful summit with the possibilities of them agreeing more than just a statement of good intent, but laying the basis for a treaty that will actually finally resolve and end the Korean War, which, as you and your listeners may know, did not actually end with a peace treaty in 1953, but only with a ceasefire, an armistice. So we have a step to take to actually end that old conflict and begin to deal with the existence of two separate countries, a North Korea and a South Korea, and figure out how they can manage their relations going forward in a peaceful way. The real wild card will be the summit between Donald Trump and the leader of North Korea. This will be the first ever meeting between the leaders of the United States and North Korea. And the fact that Trump said yes to such a meeting is actually an important step. I'm not sure he understood that what he was doing when Trump said yes. Normally, American leaders have argued that the summit should be at the end of the diplomatic process to seal the deal, whereas Trump likes to do these things at the beginning so he can take credit for everything. But we'll see how that goes. It's still too early to tell, and everybody's waiting to see how the deal with North Korea and South Korea actually goes and what might be in it. But I think we should all hope that these processes go well, because talking and trying to make agreements between countries is a much better way of managing their relations than threatening war. And you have to remember that Trump and the leader of North Korea only a few months ago were boasting to each other about the size of their nuclear buttons and how they were going to rain fire and fury on each other and so on. And so to get from that to an agreement to have a summit and to actually talk like civilized human beings, or at least to try to begin the process of having diplomacy, is something that we should support and welcome and encourage and press both sides to the extent that we can to do this in good faith. And even if you can't get everything you want in the first round of talks, to at least keep talking and give diplomacy and peace a chance.
And how do you look at the deal with Iran?
As a candidate, Trump was vehemently opposed to the deal, as he was, you know, opposed to everything that President Obama had done, be it health care, be it climate change. You know, he's so determinedly anti-Obama. But on the Iran deal, not only is it the case that the United Nations Security Council unanimously supported the Iran deal at the behest of the United States, but that the European allies of the United States all support the Iran deal. And most people in the United States support the deal for the simple reason that it does restrain Iranian nuclear capability for at least the next decade, and in some cases, on some issues, far beyond that. And it lays the basis for rebuilding the United States relationship with Iran. And, you know, Trump can huff and puff all he wants, but you know, those are the brute facts of the matter. But, you know, Trump has a blindness to consequence, as we've seen in many of his policies. And it may well be that just by sheer, you know, determination that, you know, he has to have his own way no matter what the consequences, and reimpose the sanctions on Iran. And then we'll have to wait and see what the government of Iran will do and what other countries will do and to what extent they will fall in behind the United States and to what extent they will try and keep some kind of possibility of the Iran deal and of trade and diplomacy with Iran in operation. It's very, very fraught. It's a very difficult situation that Trump has created. And, you know, John Bolton and Mike Pompeo and others in the Trump administration are all very hardline in their positions with regard to Iran. So in that regard, you know, things don't look too hopeful. But, you know, the rest of the world does have a voice in this. And the president of France has been pressing him. The chancellor of Germany is sure she will make the same case to Trump that, you know, the Iran deal is actually in everybody's best interest. But if people do want to avoid another crisis in the Middle East, now is the time for them to pick up the phone and start calling their members of Congress and say, look, we don't want another war in the Middle East. Don't want more and more crises in the world. And I think that's the way that, you know, people have to try and take control of their government.
And within this and the escalation of conventional warfare, for example, the airstrikes on Syria, which are surely in defiance of international law, they most definitely increase the likelihood of the terrible conflict spilling over into wider Middle East and potentially beyond that. How do you look at that and the conventional war within the question of these geopolitical conflicts that can become a trigger to nuclear interventions?
Well, this is a really good question, Mimi, and I think people need to keep their eye on this. You have to remember that many of the ideas that Trump has and that his supporters like Bolton and Pompeo and others have about nuclear weapons and war and the Middle East and so on, they are in many ways a recycle of the ideas that got us into this mess in the first place during the Bush administration. And this includes Iran and North Korea. So Trump, for example, supports the development by the United States of new kinds of nuclear weapons that would be more usable. This is exactly the idea that the Bush administration had when it came into power in 2000, that we need new nuclear weapons which are smaller and would be more usable and that would, you know, scare more people that the United States is serious. It was also the Bush administration that responded to a summit, a first summit between North Korea and South Korea was back in 2000, And what did the Bush administration do? They called the North Koreans the axis of evil, and then they invaded Iraq and threatened to invade Iran. And the mess that is in the Middle East was a result of Bush, Cheney, Wolfowitz, Rumsfeld, all those people that many of your listeners will remember. And we're still struggling to deal with the consequences of what their policies unleashed in the Middle East. The war in Iraq that has dragged on and on and on and taken so many lives and destroyed entire societies and left a swath of destruction, which now runs all the way to Syria. And so I think that you have to remember that this endless war that the United States unleashed in the Middle East under the Bush administration is something that is, you know, crushing the lives of entire countries. And the United States is directly responsible for the suffering of all those people, including, you know, the 500,000 people that have died so far in the conflict in Syria. So I think that worrying about future wars and the threat of nuclear weapons is profoundly important. But the fact of the matter is that there are real wars with real people dying every day, and, you know, people need to own their responsibility and try and, you know, make sure that the United States government does all that it can to end these wars as quickly as possible and accept its responsibility for having brought such suffering to those countries and those people.
I want to thank you for all of the work that you've done and for spending some time with us, Dr. Zia Mian. I want to thank you again for spending some time with us.
Thank you, Mimi.
And Zia Mian is a physicist, activist, and co-director of Princeton University's Program on Science and Global Security, and gave us some of his thoughts on moving towards nuclear abolition. This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.